Well, welcome to the Software Indie Podcast, and with me again to continue our series about the launch of briefs is Rob Ryan. How are you, Rob?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Scotty?
I am still doing good. Just remind people who you are.
I am still the CEO and co-founder of MartianCraft.
Excellent. And we were talking, have been talking about the product briefs that you released recently. And just tell people a little bit about that.
Briefs is a way for designers or anybody with an idea to interactively and visually build something that runs on the device without code. So they can take their images from a Photoshop mockup or whatnot and put them directly on the phone and play them so they can show their friends and colleagues.
Excellent. And what we're going to talk about today a little bit is pricing, particularly focusing on the Mac App Store, because that's where Briefs is launched, but equally you've launched it off there, and we're going to maybe talk about that another time. So you have priced Briefs at $200 or
$199.
Yes. Yeah, I won't scam everybody out of another dollar, which for an app on the Mac App Store is considered, well, I call that a proper priced app. For many, they're probably screaming many other things. So just take us through the story a little bit, if you will, of how you reached that figure and all the things you thought about going into that, the problems it would cause. So how you have come to a price for your own product, basically.
Well, we knew from the beginning, we really, as soon as our designers got involved and we started working on this, we wanted to go the professional tool route. And so Briefs has a UI that's heavily inspired by pro UIs like a lot of the Adobe products, and particularly the Apple pro products like Final Cut Pro, Aperture, whatnot. And we wanted to go with that pro UI because we felt this was a missing tool for app designers, and something that could work alongside Xcode but could also look at home next to Photoshop, and it would be able to sit between that. And so all of our branding, all of our UI, even the icons, everything was trying to yield this professional feeling tool, as well as professional looking tool. And for that, as I started thinking through it, I knew I always wanted to charge a higher rate. At some point I considered charging $100 for it. And when I first started showing it to some designers early on, it was actually a question a lot of people asked me. They said, what are you going to charge for this? And several of them would quickly follow it up with, you better not be charging $20 for this. And I think there's something around what a price is and what a price means to a lot of people. And so for some people, a high price is a turnoff, and they say, well, I've really got to think about this, and now I don't want to have to think about it, which I don't quite understand why people don't want to have to actually use and make an informed decision on a tool, why they just want to make a quick decision. I'm not sure. But then there's other people that look at it and say, there's a lot of work that goes in that tool. They're not going to be able to support it at $20 a license. And so right off the bat, it was an idea of, I knew the makeup of the team that was developing the tool, and I knew what it would have cost to support them. And so based on, just really spitballing what I thought, conservative estimates of our sales would look like, how much would I need to charge to support that team? So at a base level, it was just figuring out what I needed to charge to support it. And so I originally was thinking, about $100, $150. And then as I started looking at the estimates and the numbers, it's really interesting when you do something like double your price. Michael Jurowitz, I have to mention him. He's, pretty well known now for saying, take your price, double it, and if you don't lose more than half your audience, you just made money. And there's a lot of powerful stuff in that, in saying that. It seems simple to say. But as I looked at, pricing it between $100 and then moving to $200, the numbers changed dramatically. But then I also thought about it, and I said, well, if someone's going to pay $100 for a tool, likely they're willing to pay $200 for a tool, because there's really kind of these invisible boundaries that you cross in your purchase process. you know, like for me, anything under $5, I don't even consider. You know, I don't even think about. It doesn't even register. It's usually I have $5, at least $5 in my pocket just in change and in small bills. So I don't think about anything below $5. And then for a tool that I will use more than once or something that I'm going to enjoy more than once, I think that number moves up to $20. And then for something like a tool, something, a piece of software that I would use, that quickly goes up to $50 if it's something that I'm going to use multiple times. But then to get from $50 to $100, you're crossing a gap. And it's, it, I mean, even myself, a person of means who probably spends money more freely than most people do, it still feels like there's a big jump that goes from $50 to $100. But once you're over $100, the difference between $50 and $100 is huge. The difference between $100 and $150 is not very huge. And so it's this odd thing that goes into psychology when you think about, you know, these humps and what people are willing to pay. And so I already knew I needed to charge at least $100. And so I started saying, well, what if I charge $200? And a lot of the thinking around our pricing came from actually the consulting side of our business. You know, the idea is that, you know, if you're swamped, if you have too much work, the best thing you can do is raise your rates. You're going to get better clients that way. You're going to get people that are willing to spend more money. They're going to be more invested in working with you. They're going to pay better attention. They're going to want to, you know, maximize their value. Well, the same is true for software. If they're paying more money for it, they're going to be more invested in it. And with software, what's interesting is you want a user audience that's going to be pissed off when the tool doesn't work because you want them to submit bug reports. You want them to be frustrated enough that they're going to come back and tell you. And if they don't, then you're going to have these issues that people are going to be complaining about but won't be reporting back. And I think that's really, you know, the difference between a $50 app and a $200 app is that a $200 app, they're going to report those issues because they want to get their money's worth. They're like, no, I've made the decision to invest in your tool. Now I need to put the effort in to help you. And so when you, you know, I think any product you have to make, you have to have that conversation with a user where you say, look, I need your feedback. I need you to push send when it crashes and, you know, to send me that crash report. And you don't want people to get angry and just kind of walk away. Well, if I spent $5 or I spent $20 on that tool, I'm just going to walk away. I don't feel like I lost all that much money. And it's not worth my effort to continue to chase that down. I'll just go find the next tool that's $20 that does it a slightly different way, and I'll see if that works. But if it's $200, you've got their attention. And so the more we started thinking about the product, the more we started thinking about some of these behaviors, I actually said, well, that's actually the type of user audience I want. I want someone who's going to be invested. I'd rather have a smaller audience of people who really enjoy the tool or really see the potential of the tool than a larger group of people where half of them may not care at all. They just bought it because a bunch of people said to buy it, and they tried it a couple times and found out it wasn't worth it for them. And with a developer tool, there's really not the volume that's out there. You know, I don't think my grandma or my mom or my dad would use briefs. Maybe they would. You know, maybe they'll have, you know, a crazy idea. But it's kind of a different class of tool than an image editor or, you know, software for a social network or something like that. There's just not the mass appeal. And so because of that, you have a smaller audience. So again, when you get back to this idea of being able to support the product, you have to price it so that you can make enough money off that smaller audience to continue to support the product.
You've just said, I've got a whole host of questions coming off that. So where do I start? Okay, let's start with this one. I'm interested. I understand that this has to be done, but I'm interested that a large part of the pricing discussion, or a big part of what you just spoke about, was based on around what it was costing you to develop the tool was going to set the price, as opposed to basing on the value it was going to be to the people who were going to buy the tool. In other words, it was your needs defining the price as opposed to what they were getting from it. Or have I just you said that bit, but you also did the other bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, you have to do kind of both. You have to do that value assessment. The trouble with the value assessment, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I'm not saying you shouldn't think about it, but it can be a dead end, because that value is subjective. What you value and what I value could be very different. I could think a $10 cup of coffee is a waste of time, and you could think it's a revelation and it's the best thing ever. And well, I only drink one cup of coffee a week. I'm going to drink this $10 cup of coffee. We see value differently in something like that. And especially when you get into premium products or, you know, things where you have more design involved, you're becoming more subjective. But there's also this reverse psychology that goes into this as well. When you talk about value, if I own two objects, like let's say I'm a developer, so I own a bunch of Android devices as well as iOS devices. My iOS devices are my carry devices, what I prefer to use, and so I coddle them. Whereas most of my Android test devices sit in a bin. You know, I have a dish rack that I just keep all of them in. And when I need to test a particular device, I just pull them out. They don't have cases. They don't have screen protectors. I don't put a lot of effort into caring for them because there's a perception of value I have there. By charging more for a tool, let me give a better example. You go to get a ride with your friend, and friend A has this can be tough because you're British. Let's say a Ford Taurus. Is that a car in the UK?
Some would question whether that's a car or not. No, but we're taking a guess. I'll pick one for the UK, a Ford Focus or something like that.
Oh, a Focus. You know, Focus is a great day. So your friend has a Ford Focus and it's been raining that day. You've walked through the mud. You get into your friend's car. Now, some people would, out of consideration for their friend, would scrape, make sure their feet were clean before they got in their car. But you get in that person's car and you're thinking, well, it's a Ford Focus. But if friend B shows up and they're in their Mercedes-Benz E-Class, you know, nice leather interior, immaculate, even not considering your friend, you're going to wipe your feet off before you get in the car because you are going to value the cleanliness of that car. You have a higher value of that car than you do the Ford Focus. Now, you could argue whether one of them is better built. You could argue whether one of them is better designed. Some people will see a huge difference. Some people won't. Some people will value those differences. Some people won't. But because of the amount of money it costs, you respect its intrinsic value. And so by charging more for your software, there's an intrinsic value that is bestowed upon people when they see your software. So when someone... whether or not my software lives up to those expectations of a $200 app, because it's $200, there's an intrinsic value that's observed by everyone about that product.
That's a really interesting point. So how do you feel that works for you with your products when you're selling, I'm imagining primarily to designers, who I'm going to take a guess, their prime tool is, you know, Photoshop, which is an $800, $900, $1,000 product. So yeah. Are you being seen as a Ford Taurus or a Ford Focus? But actually, that's good for you because it means to them, you're actually a cheap product.
Well, I think for them, what they see is they see the quality of UI and thought and craftsmanship that went into the tool. That, you know, Photoshop gets beat up a lot, but a lot of thought went into that tool. And that's apparent to anybody that uses it. Seeing that level of craftsmanship, I think there's a little bit of a difference. I don't think they see us as the Ford – designers see us as the Ford Focus because there are similar apps that do simpler versions of what we do. Because we're charging more, I think they see that as a sign of nowhere a premium product because we're a smaller indie shop that's daring to charge more. And so I think designers recognize that. It's really other users. Like we have designers that are using it. What's an interesting demographic for us right now is people who are not really developers. They're not really designers. They have ideas, and this is the easiest way for them to articulate it. And a lot of them are entrepreneurs. Well, if you imagine, and I'm going to try very hard not to be stereotypical, but if you imagine your standard Silicon Valley entrepreneur. You know, put that mental image in your head. What kind of car does that guy drive or gal drive? BMW, Mercedes, Audi.
Yeah, probably.
Or Acura. They're driving a premium luxury sedan of some sort, or some type of sports car. They are going to be more drawn to a premium product because they want to use the tools that the pros use. And so they're going to pay more money for a more expensive tool, even though they will not necessarily use some of the pro features of the tool. And so there's some weird psychology at work there where it's one of those where if you don't charge enough for your tool, people will undervalue it. If you charge too much for your tool, they'll be upset about the price, but they will, in some cases, overvalue your tool and use it when a simpler, less expensive tool will work for them because they want to use a better tool. And it's,
I guess that works in lots of ways, doesn't it? Because there are lots of people who purchase Photoshop because it is the application that everybody knows in the industry, when actually Acorn or Pixelmator or those sort of simpler, high quality still, but sort of less expensive versions will do everything they ever need them to do.
Yes. Yes. And they're buying Photoshop because they think that's the standard. And even though they, because people are aspirational in their purchases, they don't necessarily evaluate things based on their current need. They base it on their future need. You know, I'm going to buy the MacBook Pro instead of the MacBook Air because one day I'm going to do audio recording or video editing and I'm going to want the more powerful machine. When the reality is that MacBook Air is smaller, has, you know, maybe has better battery life and is less expensive and will do everything that they're actually going to do with it. But the aspirational purchaser is looking and saying, actually, I want to do more. And that's, it sounds cynical when I say it that way, but I actually don't mean it cynical at all. I actually think aspirational users are the best. I want people to get excited when they use my tool. I want them to see a world of possibilities, not a world of limitations. And that's where I think your entrepreneur skews different from your designer. The designer right now is looking at our tool and seeing what it can do and then quickly finds kind of the edges, which is great because, again, they've invested in this tool. They're going to give us feedback. They're going to tell us how we can expand the tool to make it better for them because now they're invested. You know, they bought this through the Mac App Store, so the expectation is that 1.x releases will be free. So they pay for it now, and as we improve it, they're getting continued value from that purchase. Whereas an entrepreneur is looking at it and saying, well, one day I'm going to use all these capabilities. I'm going to have this potential. And they're exciting because they want to go and talk about the product. They're excited using it. They're happy with the results they see. And they're, you know, almost giddy to use some of the more advanced features and to show it off because to them it feels, you know, for lack of a better word, magical. And again, a lot of that can be driven just by the cost. I really think the price of your app is part of its design, in my mind. That it sets the tone for your product in a way that few other features can.
That's a really interesting point of view. I mean, I was looking at some car reviews. We're coming into a car show here. We'll have to rename ourselves the Accidental Car Show. a car that is manufactured in the same factory. It is exactly the same car. In fact, the three manufacturers are actually all owned by the same parent company. And one model, the only difference is the badge, really. One model is released as a VW, one is a Skoda, and one is a Seat. And they all have different prices. And it's all about brand awareness, even though it's exactly the same car. And equally, they will all have second, you know, different used prices later on as well, when that's over. So the price is, people expect to pay more for a VW than they do for a Skoda. And it's an expect, so you can set expectations about your software through what you charge for it. And so this race to get it as cheap as possible to get people to buy it, even though that might be financially viable for you, is not necessarily the right move to make.
Well, it depends. And I think there's, you know, there's been a lot of good debate about, you know, adding trials to the App Store. And Marco Arment wrote an interesting piece last week, which I'll dig up if you have show notes and we can send it.
Yep, we do.
Where he's talking about he's talking about trials and how adding trials to the App Store will change this buying pattern that he very much, I think, enjoyed with Instapaper. And I know several other iOS developers who enjoyed success through this where, well, now I can consider all my options. So now I'm not picking which one I think is the best up front. I'm saying, well, I'm going to buy all these $4 or $5 apps. I'll buy five of them. And then the one that I like the best is the one I'll keep. And I think the Mac App Store is a little different from the iOS App Store in the sense that Mac developers are still seeking out customers. They're still looking to build a relationship, someone that they can build updates and mold a tool into something that they ultimately want. It's more of a conversation. Whereas iOS, the numbers are so huge and there's so many people buying your software that it's much more difficult to facilitate that customer relationship. And some would argue that Apple makes it more difficult because we don't get direct access to them. When someone buys briefs through my own store, I get their email address, their name. I can reach out to them in a way that I cannot reach out to the people that buy it through the Mac App Store. I don't know. And when you're talking about support, when you're trying to get help for this tool that's $200, you know, a lot of the people are saying, well, I've bought your tool. And the realization is that if they bought it through my own store, I already know they bought the tool. But if they bought it through the Mac App Store, I don't know. And so I think a lot of this pricing and how things are priced are geared towards, are you trying to build a base of customers that enjoy your software and build that brand? Or are you doing something like iOS where you build something that's quality enough that someone will pay that $5 for it? And then when considering 10 options, you'll be one of those 10 options that they'll consider. It's why you have so many weather apps. It's why you have so many calculator, was it tip calculators for the longest time? That's why you can have so many Twitter clients. I can afford to own all of the iOS Twitter clients and switch between them. But in reality, I only use one. And so the Mac App Store, by being able to, you know, distribute free trials through your, you know, through your own website, you can charge more because you're saying, look, go and try it and see if it's right for you. And if they come back and say, this wasn't right for me, that's okay because I don't need the volume because I can charge a higher price. You know, so many users have come to me and written and said, I would have bought your app if it was $50, or I would have bought your app if it was $100. I wouldn't have even thought about it. And I'm writing back to them and saying, I'm actually glad that you are thinking about it before you buy it, because I'd rather you think about it, decide it's not for you, and then find the tool that is right for you than buy my tool and waste $50 or $100 for a tool that doesn't do what you want to do. By charging $200, I'm almost forcing people to use the trial. I'm not forcing them. There, we still had some people that the moment it went for sale in the Mac App Store, they bought it right away. But for a lot of people, and even for me, if I was going to buy a $200 piece of software, I would try it first. I would want to see if it's right for me. And what it does is it gets you a quality customer. It gets you somebody that you know sees the potential of your tool, wants to use it, and better, wants to make it better, because they're going to help you make the tool better in the end. And so I think the difference between these, you know, the iOS App Store and the Mac App Store is that conversation. I don't think it's necessarily trials or it's necessary. There's a lot of artifacts that people are getting around. But to me, I think it comes down to, are you having a conversation with your customers, or are you mass producing software? And iOS feels more like that mass produced software that you just want to be on the shelf as one of the options when people are looking, what kind of macaroni and cheese am I going to buy? Whereas a car, you still go to a showroom, you talk to a salesman, you test drive the car, you do all these things. It's a bigger purchase that you have to think about much more. And I think by pricing our app at $199, we're skewing more towards, you know, we've kind of destroyed that car metaphor, but we're skewing more towards the car. We're saying, I want people to invest the time to see if this tool is right for them and make that decision. And I'm confident enough in my team's ability and my ability to design a product that people want to use. And that's the flip side of the price. It's like, you're really doubling down on your ability to produce high quality software, because I'm going to charge a higher price for it. And I know I'm still going to get customers because I built a quality product that people want. And that's where I think it goes back to your original point about evaluating the value it is to others. I still think that's important, but I think you've got to consider the other business realities as well.
So I'm not aware if you have much competition in this space. You have mentioned there are other tools that do things in a different way. But how much did what they do and their price affect you in any way in the price you chose?
Their price didn't affect us. I think some of the way that they did things changed. We're a good example, a tool that we use. If you're looking for a tool that's of the same idea of Briefs, but the $200 price tag throws you off, I highly consider trying Prototypes. It's written by Duncan Wilcox. It's a very nice app, and it does a lot of the basic things that Briefs does. And what it does is it allows you to connect a series of screens together through hotspots, and it builds an HTML prototype. And I'll let you know he's able to share that with people through a clever way where you can kind of put this up on a web server and then use the bookmark sharing to kind of put it on your device. And he's built a very nice experience around that to make it very easy for you. But it's HTML. It's not native code. Briefs were doing native code. So our animations are native core animations instead of kind of their WebKit approximations. But his tool is very good, and it has limitations that I see, but it also exists in a different space. It's a much less expensive app. You don't have to download an iOS companion app to run it. So I'm sure for some people that's going to be a simpler process. But we were targeting very different parts of the market. We're building a tool that really is becoming a living document for your spec, whereas he was building these quick prototypes to kind of put something together to demo to a client and then immediately dive into code and start building it. If you really want to get into the animations and the timing and all the different permutations of things, Prototypes doesn't scale beyond that, I think, because, his idea is that, then you take it and you go off and you build it in code. We were looking for a document that we could distribute to our clients and, designers could live in this document. So as they update their production art, as they make minor tweaks and changes, our file and our tool supports various permutations in that workflow where we can show the differences and the tweaks and then give something ultimately to a developer that they can turn around and build, giving them this very rich, very detailed spec. And so we were going after something very different. And so I felt like our model was more akin to the way people are using Photoshop right now. Now if you're a developer, you usually get a spec as a Photoshop document, maybe an accompanying PDF to explain some of the animations and short little line graphics. And what we wanted to do was kind of combine those two and make a more powerful document. So because of that, that more heavily influenced our price. Because I think the data that our users put into this and maintaining that and securing that, that was, I don't know. I think ultimately we weren't as influenced by the price because we were doing something different. We were doing something kind of more comprehensive than what other tools were doing. So
I guess if you had been producing an HTML proofing tool like Prototypes, then Prototypes, the price of Prototypes would have been more relevant.
Exactly. They would have been a more direct competitor. Whereas I think in a cursory review, they look like direct competitors when you first look at Briefs before you dive into it. But as you dive into it more, you realize there's a lot more there. And then that's a support thing we've had to work through is we've had some people that push back on the price and say, why would I pay five times the cost of Prototypes to buy your tool? And I said, well, if Prototypes does what you need it to do, then you shouldn't pay five times the price of it. I wouldn't download our tool just to do the same thing. But if you want to do more, if you want to use more of the capabilities of our tool, then, Prototypes isn't going to give you that. And there isn't anything else that is going to give you that. For any price. So we were kind of coming into a new market in the sense that we, I don't know. I mean, no one wants to say they did something like what Apple did, where they go into an existing space and kind of do something. But I feel like we kind of took elements from a series of tools that people were building and trying, you know, and we kind of put them together in a comprehensive package. Like another thing that we do is we allow you to preview the brief while you're building it live on the device through Briefs Live. And there are a lot of mirroring tools that are out there. Scala Preview by Mark Edwards is one, and that's free. There's also Xscope by Icon Factory, which I use all the time, and they allow you to mirror onto the tool. And then there's, of course, the granddaddy of them all, LiveView, which was just a window that you could move around on your Mac, and it would show the contents on your device. We have features like that, but it's integrated into our product. So you're not just looking at a mirror of what's on your Mac. You're actually looking at a live brief that you can start to interact with, and it'll animate, and you can go to different scenes. You can use it as well as look at it. And so we took a bunch of these different ideas, so some of the ideas from prototypes, some of the ideas from those other tools, and combined them into an entire ecosystem. And I think by doing that, I felt like we've raised the overall value of the product to a user. They can still use these other tools, but we're now providing a one-stop shop to kind of do all of this stuff and put it into a consolidated system.
That's fascinating. Do you think we've given pricing a reasonably broad coverage there, or is there something?
If I've answered all your questions, then I would say yes.
Well, my question is, how did you decide to do that? So you've answered that one for me.
Terrific.
Okay, great. So Rob, just tell people where they can follow you and find out a bit more about you.
They can follow me on Twitter. I'm in app.net. I'm Captain Taco, CaptainTaco. They can follow Briefs on Twitter, Briefs app, BRIEFSAPP. Or they can go to giveabrief.com to find out more information about Briefs and download our trial. It's free, no time limit on it.
Okay, so that's great. And we'll obviously put all the links that we've spoken about in the show notes. My name is Scotty. This has been the Software Indie Podcast. Hope it's been useful to you. Please check out our blog as well at softwareindie.com. And until next time, you take care.